Welcome to the Baseball America Podcast.
Coming to you from the Baseball America Podcast nook.
Controls, you're throwing strikes. Command is you're hitting the spot.
That's stupid. I'm sorry. I'm going to rant about this again because that's just stupid, John.
This is
so ridiculous. I'm tired of it.
If he was in the home run derby, I'd put him out of a decent chance of winning it against the big leaguers.
Surprised you could even hear us over the din of Ronnie McCabe's tape gun.
Here we go in 3, 2, 1. Play ball.
Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with Ben Badler and J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. I want to remind you that for the first time ever, Baseball America has brought you the complete midseason prospect update for all 30 organizations. It's an exclusive digital-only product that brings you information not available anywhere else. Get it all for just $4.99 now that the trade deadline has passed. But get ready for your September call-ups with the Baseball America midseason prospect update. Buy it from the App Store on iTunes or Zinio on Zinio newsstands at Zinio.com, Z-I-N-I-O.com. So first time we did the midseason prospect update, enjoyed working on that, gearing up for the prospect handbook in the offseason. But there's still some obviously major league season to be played. And, we had a pretty eventful week in the major leagues last week with a lot of the rumors regarding Rusney Castillo. And obviously Ben has been all over that. We had our man Walter Villa down in Miami go to the Rusney Castillo workout. I think, Ben, that's probably like your only regret of the whole Rusney Castillo. Well, not your only regret of the Rusney Castillo business, because I feel like you've been on it from when this guy first defected. But it sounds like the workout was a lot of fun. It's too bad we couldn't work that trip out, but it was definitely a circus atmosphere around this guy. And it seems like Rusney Castillo just kind of standing on the shoulders of the Jose Abreus, the Yasiel Puig, the Yoenis Céspedes, and getting the largest contract of a Cuban free agent. It's almost like he owes some some finder's fee to those other Cubans who defected before him and the circus that kind of grew up around him before he signed with the Red Sox.
Yeah, I hope he gives them like a fruit basket or some sort of nice gift, because if you ask most scouts, I think how you would stack up, you know, Céspedes and Abreu and Castillo at the time they left, you know, Céspedes was this scouting darling. He was, you know, in terms of performance, he was dominant in Cuba, hit for power, hit for average, and dominated at international tournaments, and was a guy who was at the time a center fielder with premium athleticism and a ton of tools. Obviously, you can see those and the arm strength and the power that he's showing now. He would probably be, if you stack those three guys up, he'd probably be number one for most scouts at the time they left. There were more questions about Jose Abreu. He was more of a split camp guy, but he certainly had some of his some strong believers who've obviously been justified based on what he's done this year. And
it's worked out well.
And Castillo, it's amazing, because the money obviously goes in reverse order of how you'd stack them up. I'd probably put Puig in a different category just because of how little he had played on the national team and how little of an opportunity teams had to scout him after he left Cuba. But you know, if you stack just those three guys up, I think Castillo would come in third. But obviously, he's benefited from the success that Abreu has had, and Céspedes has had, and Puig has had, and with Soler in the minor leagues. I mean, he's been injured, granted, but at the same time, you look at the performance that he's put up and the tools that he's still showing. This guy is one of the most more dynamic prospects in the minors. I mean, a lot of these Cuban guys who are coming over who've been on the national team and had a lot of success there and who scouts have really been high on have so far proven to be worth the investment. I think that's given ownership a lot more confidence across baseball to invest in these guys when they do come over. So, you know, is Castillo going to be as good as Abreu or Céspedes? I don't think he will be, but I think that the success that Puig and Céspedes and Abreu have had has certainly contributed to the confidence of ownership and for scouts as well to be willing to go, you know, put themselves on the line and be willing to invest the kind of money that the Red Sox just paid to sign Castillo.
Ben, along these lines, how much is it affected by just the fact that nowadays, with the rules that there are on the draft, that the rules that there are on international spending for international amateurs, you know, who aren't veteran pro players, it's essentially the only place left that you can just kind of throw money at a player. This is kind of, the Cubans now are in a very unique situation, it seems like.
Yeah, there's no draft pick compensation, and you're not getting them at the tail end of their career. You know, you're not signing these guys like most major league free agents who are coming out and they're 30, 31, 32 years old. You know, maybe you're going to get a guy who hits free agency at 28 or so, but for the most part, you're getting guys on the tail end of their careers, whereas these Cuban guys are coming over and they're, you know, 26, 27 years old. Yosmani Tomas is coming over now, and he's 23 years old. He's going to be 24, I believe, in November. So you're getting these guys who have no draft pick compensation attached to them, and they're really on the either in the prime of their career or heading into the prime years of their career at a time when most teams are trying to lock up their young talent to long-term extensions, so guys are hitting the free agent market later than ever. So these teams clearly have more money than they've ever had before, and there's fewer avenues for them to spend it because of the restrictions on draft signings and international signings at the amateur level of guys who are under 23 years old for the international players. And they need to spend it, or they want to spend it somewhere. And, you know, two of the best places to spend it are on the Cuban players and on Asian foreign professionals if they're, you know, if the star power is there, like a Masahiro Tanaka.
There are two ways I could go in this conversation. You guys help steer me. One part of this conversation is that how much more information it seems like we have on Cuban players now than, say, 10 years ago when this more recent flood of players started. I just kind of peg it to like Yunel Escobar in 2005 and Brian Pena when they came over. And Escobar even went into the draft and was a second-round pick. We slapped him into the top 200, the pre-draft top 200, basically because he was Cuban and a shortstop. You know, like we had scraps of information. So we could go in that direction and talk about the more information, or I almost like this part of me that wants to go back, and I've seen ESPN doing these what if things. It's like I would be much more interested in, like, what if you go back and take the Cuban players who dominated amateur baseball in the 80s and 90s, the Omar Linareses, the Orestes Quindelans, and these guys. How good must those players, or how good a big leaguers would those players have been? Because you had apocryphal stories about it back then, but now we see these guys who dominated Serie Nacional in this decade and how good they've been as big leaguers with those older players. It's probably more instructive to talk about point A, but I mean, I don't know.
Point A is where I'd say to steer you on, Ben, which is just the question, you know, well, you phrased it pretty well.
I mean, yeah, I mean, how much more information do we have now, Ben? Obviously, you were able to get more information because of we sent you to Japan to watch these guys in the WBC in 2013. A lot of these guys, you know, scouts saw these guys in Mexico in 2009. When Cuba was in WBC there, right? Well, some of these guys are playing in Japan now, obviously in NPB. But I guess the other part of this, Ben, is that you're able to watch a lot of these guys basically on YouTube and over the internet. Just how much more information did you have, or do clubs have, on these players? And how, when you talk to scouts about these guys, do they ever compare the amount of information they have now to what they might have had 10 years ago? I mean, it just seems like there's so many more chances to see these players than there ever used to be.
Yeah, I think things are changing very quickly for teams, and I think some teams are realizing that they're very behind when it comes to the information that they have on these Cuban players. I mean, you know, we're putting out these rankings and scouting reports and all these Cuban players that you know, I've watched over the last. You know, I think I've seen about four different international tournaments out of them in the last 18 months and at least 50 or more games, full games of these guys in the Cuban National Series just from the last year alone. I think the internet has really leveled the or really increase the amount of information that's available on these guys beyond just the stats. There's a lot better communication tools than there were 10 years ago or even 5 years ago to be able to get information on these players, to be able to see these players firsthand, to be able to see these guys on video. And there's a lot of teams that I think are playing catch up in terms of the ability, their ability to acquire information on these players. I mean, just seeing these guys at international tournaments, that's certainly important. I mean, the Cuban team just played earlier this month in August. They played some, you know, little exhibition series in Colombia, and I mean, there was several international scouting directors there. There were some pretty heavy hitter scouts there, and these were just Cuban guys playing. You know, a bunch of the better players from Cuba who are playing a bunch of guys who were, you know, released from Colombia and a bunch of semi-pro guys, and
so guys who aren't as good as like Jonathan and Donovan Solano. I mean, those are two pretty good Colombian players I can think of. These are all guys not that good.
Right, and these guys are flying in to see them just to get any eyes they can on these Cuban players in person. But there's so much you miss when you only go on these international tournaments and international events if you're not seeing them playing every day, especially in a more comfortable environment where they're playing in Cuba. So there's definitely a lot more information that we have on these guys, and it varies from player to player. You know, somebody like Ulieski Gurriel or Alfredo Despaigne or you know, Jose Abreu before he left, these are guys who were, you know, seen all the time on the national team and were pretty well known. There's some other guys, obviously, who don't have the same exposure, so they're certainly less known about them. But I think our knowledge of Cuban players, of anybody who really has talent and major league potential in Cuba, there's a lot more that we know about them today compared to what we may have known 5 or 10 years ago on these guys.
I mean, that even goes to something as basic as age. I mean, 10 years ago, you know, I remember how useful it was. Like, hey, the what was the guy that the Yankees had? Juan Miranda, first baseman?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Where he told the Yankees he was 3 years younger than he really was, and the Yankees kept on telling me, oh no, he's 25. And I'm like, I have the media guide from when he played against the Orioles in 1999, and his birthday is in 82 for that event. I mean, like, I think you're wrong. You know, I mean, like, that's where we were 10 years ago, and now you have just like years of data on a lot of these guys playing in 15U IBAF tournaments, or back when they were 16U, 18U, we have just so much more data points. So part of it, I think, is the internet, but part of it is just the spread and the growth of international baseball. Feels like, Ben, the WBC and these more international youth tournaments give us more, these are more established, and it feels like these are now must-see events for evaluators for all 30 clubs. If not all 30, they need to be for all 30.
Yeah, I think some teams are reevaluating, or certainly should reevaluate some of their practices with regards to how they evaluate Cuban players. I know some teams have certain people who are hired their main focus is just the Cuban market, which is a little bit strange because it's not like you're, you know, a Dominican or a Venezuelan supervisor where your job is to cover a whole bunch of players that are going to be eligible to sign. And in Cuba, it's, you don't know whether they're going to come out and or whether they're even ever going to come out. And you might never have a chance to sign a player you scout for 10 to 15 years. But when they do come out, it's much more important if you can hit on a guy like Jose Abreu, or if you have information on Yasiel Puig, for example, before he leaves, because you might not get a chance to evaluate him as much as you'd like to once he's outside of Cuba. The dollars are so much higher on the investment on these guys compared to what you're looking at in signing a 16-year-old kid out of the Dominican Republic or Colombia or Mexico. This market has become so important for teams that it's surprising to me that that you don't, and the most, or that every team doesn't have somebody who's dedicated to just covering the Cuban market, or who's at least sole focus is to make sure that, you know, their team has knowledge of every or every major league caliber player who's in Cuba.
Two questions along those lines. One is that how much of an do the we haven't seen it play out this way, but does Toronto have an advantage, or, you know, because I know they're part of MLB, but at the same time, if you're a Canadian citizen, getting into Cuba is not really an issue. I know it's a little easier in recent years for U.S. citizens as well, but or is there still pretty much a complete embargo on actually scouting players in Cuba? And the second part with that is you've talked about some teams are a little behind us. Who do you see as the teams who really are on top of it when it comes to scouting, you know, the Cuban talent?
Yeah, I think if you were a Blue Jays scout and you wanted to fly into Cuba and wear your Blue Jays hat, I don't think that would go over so well. I mean, the thing is that every team employs a whole bunch of international scouts who live in the Dominican Republic and Venezuela and Mexico, and Mexico and Venezuela in particular are countries that have positive relationships with Cuba. So there's all sorts of ways that you can work for a team and still fly into Cuba and see players. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't recommend doing it, especially if you're an American scout living in the United States and need to get your passport stamped through there. But, you know, I'm sure there are ways that people can go into Cuba and see these guys firsthand. You know, a much safer way, I think, is probably to just you know, they televise a lot of games in Cuba, and you know, if you're savvy enough, you should be able to get your hands on copies of those games. So I think that would be a much safer thing for clubs to do rather than risk going into Cuba and then just see these guys when they are at these international tournaments. And. And you'll get to see the majority of the top players up close and taking BP and get a little bit closer look at them when they do go to these international tournaments.
And which are the teams that really have kind of already put in a significant effort to make sure they're very much on you know, it's a couple. I know there's a lot, but are there any that jump out like that are really on top of making sure that they are at all these events?
I think you know, most teams, when it comes to going to these international tournaments, I think most teams at this point have realized that, all right, we need to be here. There's whether it's this small tournament in Colombia or the World Baseball Classic, where pretty much everybody goes to. I think every team realizes that, you know, these guys are we can't afford to miss on these guys when they're out. So I think most teams are realizing that these are they need to do more when it comes to being able to evaluate and get information on all these Cuban guys.
It just really seems like, Ben, the key is, as the dollars go higher, is having more certainty, to use the word that you used in the article that we're pegging this podcast to. The more information you have, the more you can be certain and go up in dollars on these players, which is kind of why it makes the Yasiel Puig contract. It's what we wrote at the time, where you just, you know, I think you wrote, elaborated on it at the time, like, it would be very difficult for any club to have a high amount of certainty on Yasiel Puig at the time, and information on him was just pretty sketchy. But, I mean, it really does make the fact that he got $12 million more than Jorge Soler, and both got nine-year contracts. There was quite a bit more information about Soler than there was about Puig at the time. That was a $42 million gamble that now looks like a $42 million bargain, obviously, for the Dodgers. But, I mean, just maybe if you can just kind of put it, because in the present context, how much more information do we have on a player like Castillo compared to a guy like Puig, specifically, who I know is an outlier case in many ways. But he just seemed like at that time he was just this mystery man who's being shopped around Mexico, and it was kind of like a almost a circus, it seemed like, they grew up around Puig. Even his scouting, it was very, very hard player to scout and to evaluate at that time, right?
Yeah, that's part of the challenge of scouting Cuban players is that, you know, you want to evaluate a major league free agent or even all the way down to a 16-year-old kid in the Dominican Republic or an 18-year-old high school player. I mean, if you just want to limit it to the amateur side, if you're making decisions in the draft, for example, you're going to have a lot more certainty of information, or at least I would hope you would, if you've done your job on the 21-year-old college junior who you're going to have followed for hopefully at least 3 years, probably have information on them going back to high school. You're not going to have any difficulty seeing these players with a lot of frequency leading up to the time when you're eligible to draft them. If you go down to a high school senior, you know, there's going to be, if you want to see them play every game that they play on in the summer before the draft and during their high school season, you can get a lot of certainty on them then. But it's not going to be what it is compared to the college junior. You're going to have more certainty and more history on. In Cuba, it can be extremely variable based on how many times you've seen these guys at international events or whether they've been on the international circuit at all, going back to their junior national team days and how much you're able to see these guys play on video when they or possibly even in person while they're still in Cuba. So that can create some pretty disparate levels of certainty on these guys. I mean, we talk about a guy like Alfredo Despaigne or Frederick Cepeda, who's, you know, these guys have been on the Cuban national team for, for several years. I mean, Cepeda's probably, or he is heading into the twilight of his career, and I'm sure he's not going to, or I would be very surprised if he ever left Cuba. I mean, these are guys that any scout who's been following Cuban baseball should be extremely familiar with these guys. But then you have a guy like, a Raisel Iglesias who you've seen at international tournaments and you have some more information on, but maybe not quite as high not quite as high of a certainty level on him as you'd like, or somebody, a younger player like Guillermo Aviles or Andy Ibañez, you know, two of the better young position players in Cuba, but they haven't really had the chance to play on the national stage in recent years. I mean, Ibañez was at the World Baseball Classic and did play last year, last summer a little bit, but beyond that, that's really not a lot of information. It's easy to see those guys at, you know, one international tournament or see a VLA's playing against the U.S. college national team last month in Cuba and try to come away with a bunch of conclusions based on, a limited look. But I think that's a dangerous thing to do. So all these guys in Cuba, that's one of the big factors is some of these guys you know extremely well, like a Yoenis Cespedes or a Jose Abreu. And then some of these guys, there's much less certainty about the confidence that you have in the evaluation of these guys.
Well, Ben, you only have I'm not going to give away the list. Obviously, we want you to we want you to subscribe and check out Ben's top 15 players still in Cuba with some bonus players included. But only two of the top 10 are pitchers, Ben, and it just feels like this is something that has been going on in Cuba for more than a decade. JJ's heard me make this rant for a long time. Cuba's national team dominance ended the day that Jose Contreras left the island. And he was the ace for Cuba's national team for 6-7 years. And he had Ciro Lisay and Jorge Vera at the same time. And before them, you had Omar Ejete and the Levon Hernandez and El Duque. He had this golden age of Cuban pitchers, really, from like the 80s through the early parts of the last decade. But since Contreras, really, outside of Aroldis Chapman, Cuba's national team never really developed an ace and never won internationally any significant tournaments Not when anybody else.
Tip of the cap to Pedro Luis Lazo, too.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for bringing him. I mean, obviously on the national team, he was more a closer than starter, but he's the all-time wins leader in Serie Nacional history. So I'm glad you remembered Pedro Lazo, because I didn't. But it's been a decade-long down cycle for pitching in Cuba, and it feels like that's still the case. So the first question I have for you is, first, is that still the case? And second of all, what are the reasons that maybe scouts or maybe that you might have of why that might be the case? Why is this talent cycle for pitching in Cuba just so down?
Yeah, it's kind of funny that the hardest thrower on the planet is Aroldis Chapman.
Right. It's true irony.
And you know, when he was healthy, the guy with probably the nastiest stuff in the game among starters, Jose Cuban. Fernandez, yep. Also Cuban. And then you look at...
And Carlos Rodon, top college stuff the last 3 years, Cuban-American, but still Cuban. He could pitch for Cuba in a World Baseball Classic team if we didn't have actual Cubans.
But, yeah, just the rest of the talent in Cuba, it's so rare to find a guy who throws 95 there or who has a plus fastball. There's just such a lack of velocity there. I mean, there's some younger guys who can throw hard, like a Yasiel Sierra, but he doesn't have the command yet. But or a Jorge Ruiz who does have that feel for pitching and could be a guy who could carry the national team for a while if he does stay. But yeah, most guys in Cuba, it's just almost every guy is this like 85 to 88 throwing like a slurvy breaking ball. I mean, you even see the guys that they just pitched against the college national team. I mean, there's a couple of lefties who, one of them can, maybe crack 90 if he really humps up, and another one in Julio Martinez who, throws also 85 to 88 and with a really good curveball. But, if he comes over to the States, he's going to get crushed by the time he gets to the upper levels.
Right.
There's just such a lack of major league caliber pitching, and we see that in the guys who come over. It's almost other than Chapman and Armando Rivero is doing all right in the Cubs system, and Jorge Despaigne I think is going to come back to earth pretty quickly with the Padres. I mean, Miguel Gonzalez is not looking so hot with the Phillies.
He left his arm in Taiwan that game against the U.S. college national team where he threw, 10 and a third innings against Garrett Cole?
Yeah, I mean, most of these guys are more along the lines of, Unieski Maya or
right.
Javier Hinojosa, who signed with the Red Sox. There's just not the caliber of pitching there. It's bad. And then when you watch a game in Serie Nacional, we can see the guys who are on the national team, and most of those guys aren't really major league caliber arms. You can imagine what the rest of the league looks like.
Yeah.
Once you dip into a Cuban bullpen, it's the caliber of arm is generally not getting better. And you can see on this list, it's very heavily slanted towards the position players, that's for sure.
It also does create some bad habits for the hitters, doesn't it? Because you saw when you went to Japan, and you see there's almost softball swings for some of these guys because you don't have to be short and direct when you're facing 85 to 86 on a regular basis.
No, and that's one of the things, too, that we've seen guys like Cespedes and Abreu make adjustments to, and it's a credit to them, and it's impressive that they've been able to do it. Is because, yeah, it's a big question mark. How are you going to respond to facing pitchers in the States where, I mean, geez, every amateur pitcher in these All America games we're watching is throwing 93. The major league arms are throwing harder than ever. Every bullpen arm seems like they're throwing 95 plus these days. How are you going to react to that when you're very rarely seeing anybody who's thrown over 92 and most guys don't even top 90?
So you're saying that you're saying Isla De La Juventud doesn't have multiple 95 guys coming out of the bullpen? We had a little phone outage there that spared a bad joke. So we're just going to move on like the joke never happened. I don't know. JJ can't do that. But the rest of you the rest of you get that benefit. We do have a couple questions on Twitter. Obviously, if you're listening to the podcast, you may be familiar with us. He's at JJCoop36. That's JJ Cooper. Ben's at Ben Badler. I'm at John Manuel BA. And Red Goodish asked, if each is given an MLB center field job this winter, rank Betts, Bradley, and Castillo for the next 6 years. JJ, I'm going to start with you. I mean, obviously, Ben has more information on Rusney Castillo, but Betts, Bradley, especially, and what you've read of Castillo, how do you line those three guys up?
Bradley's a distant third because
sadly, but true.
Defense has been everything you know that you would hope for. I don't think you can completely write off his bat, but at this point, you do have to say that this is not that he got 100 at bats. He's been given two tries; it hadn't worked yet, and you know, so he's a distant third. I would say. I'd be interested if Ben disagrees on this. I still have Betts first because to me, you know, you are looking at someone with excellent athleticism, very young, should continue to get better, and just has a very advanced understanding of hitting for his age.
He's just such a dynamic athlete. It sounds like Castillo also is a dynamic athlete. I mean, I think I would like Betts a little bit better if he were a second baseman. In this question of center field to center field, I think I'd give a slight edge to Castillo because it sounds like has a chance to hit for more power, Ben. Is that how you'd line it up?
Yeah, I think where Castillo is right now, he certainly has the highest power potential of that group, although I think in games it's more of a line drive type stroke. But, yeah, I would still take Betts over Castillo. I think you know, Castillo is definitely an aggressive hitter. He's not a complete free swinger up there, but I don't think he's going to give you a lot of
on-base.
He's not going to draw a lot of walks to boost that on-base percentage like Betts can. I think he's going to be, you know, Betts gives you speed. He gives you a guy who can hit, who has very good plate discipline and some surprising stock for his size too. I would definitely put him first of that group. And I don't know, Bradley, it's that season that he's had has just been so disappointing. I mean, that's a gold glove center fielder if he can hit barely enough just to stay on the field every day. But obviously, that hasn't been the case this year. But maybe I'm just a Bradley apologist, but I still see, well, I was going to say more upside than he's shown this year. It's hard to get
much less. It's a real trouble.
Yeah, but I mean, this is a guy who, I mean, he dominated at every level he was at, up through the higher levels of the minor leagues, and this year he just fell flat. And it's, you know, it's like you said, it's not like he wasn't given the opportunity. It's not like he was just up for a month or 6 weeks and then the Red Sox pushed him back down to AAA. They, you know, they gave him every opportunity all season long up until this month, and then they had to send him back down. So, but I think Bradley's approach is good. I still like his offensive upside. You know, even if he can just be a steady player, I think the defense is there for him to be an above average player. But you know, I don't know what the Red Sox are going to do with all these guys. I mean, I understand, you know, if you really like Castillo, go ahead and jump on him and figure out what to do with all these players later. But I'm not really sure what they're going to do with Bradley. I guess he looks like certainly the odd man out, but Betts is really the more curious guy. I'm not really sure where they're going to put him next year.
It is a tough question. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what they. I don't know. I don't know what they plan on doing with Mookie Betts. He's athletic enough to try a lot of different things, but it's more of a right side of the infield arm, and he does not. You know, their biggest opportunities right now are shortstop and third base, and those are not optimal for Mookie Betts. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do with him. So that was a good question by Red. We also have a question from a friend of BA, Tom Reardon. He's the sports information director at UNC Wilmington. He's the guy who, for baseball anyway, he's the guy who directed us to Matt Batts as an intern for us last summer. Matt Batts now dazzling in the Twins organization. But Tom asked about Tyler DeLoach. He's been solid at two levels for the Angels this summer. Where is he in their plans, JJ? Not a Cuba question, so I'm going to let you answer a Tyler DeLoach question.
He's still, you know, a late round pick. He's had a very good year. He made it up to Double A.
So what you're saying is either the top five for the Angels.
I was going to say, you're talking 85, 86, 87 mile an hour fastball, you know, understanding of how to throw, you know, change up for strikes as well. Deceptive.
So a top 10 guy for the Angels.
A top 10 guy potentially, you know, I mean.
He sounds like a Cuban guy.
If you thought the Angels' top 30 last year was, they were the clear number 30 of the organizations. And really last year, I wrote the list, you edited it. You got to like number 11, and as I put it, it's like, look, we can order these however right. you want to at this point, because it was pretty fringy from that point on.
Let's just rank them how they fit best on the page.
Well,
we didn't do that.
Well, going to this year's, the Angels have promoted several guys from that group. They've traded away a ton of guys from that top 30.
They've DFA'd a few.
This list this year is going to be worse. It's going to be rougher. And I do think, Deloach, again, I don't think he really profiles as having a significant big league career. In no way does that mean, though, that he will not. He is a starter who's reached Double A, who's had some success.
He has 10 strikeouts per nine for his minor league career.
I think he probably makes the 30. And you know, using the BA grade, he may make the 30 as a 40 medium. And that wow. may make the 30. I mean, that may make the 30.
Well, that made the 30 last year, for sure. Ben, back on the Cuban question, especially in the Castillo discussions, I mean, how tough was it to sort out fact from fiction on some of these rumors? I mean, like, there are so many Cuban free agents now, names get thrown out there as rumors. It feels like they get thrown out when the agent is the only source and players get played up. How difficult was it to sort out that fact from fiction, not just on Castillo, but also just on some of the other players who've signed over the years, whether it's Puig, Cespedes, these kind of guys? I mean, it feels like that's one of the bigger things, is that from a media standpoint, there's a different way to have to cover it now, too, because I have a feeling that most people don't know that you can watch these guys play on the internet.
Yeah, I think, and that was one of the motivations too for putting this project and these rankings and these scouting reports together, is that, you know, we want to know these guys as well as we can before they leave Cuba. If you're waiting to hear about them after they leave Cuba, that's not the optimal way to do it. I mean, I don't think that's the best way to do it, for sure. Then it's, you know, for the most part, when a big time guy leaves, it's usually somebody who has played on the national team, somebody who is you know, a pretty well known guy. So, you know, when Jose Abreu left, and we had this emergency Jose Abreu podcast. I mean,
right?
Jonas Cespedes left, we knew he was going to be a big deal. When Raisel Iglesias or Aryu Barrena, or he was Aryu Barrena,
right?
You know, when these guys leave, we usually make a big deal of the guys who we know are going to be made a big deal about by the team. So, but then, yeah, you do see other. I remember getting questions: who's going to be the better player, Daniel Carbonell or Rusney Castillo? And
right,
just like scratching my head at this, like, how can this really? Is this like a serious question? I mean, it's not even close.
It was a $70 million valuation difference between those two players, right?
Yeah, and that's so, yeah, or like Maicel Severio is another name I get asked about. This guy throws and, you know, he doesn't crack 90 miles an hour unless something has changed very recently. But, you know, the main guys tend to be the ones who play on the national team, or if there's some reason they haven't played on the national team. You know, that's why we, you know, put this together, is so that we know all these guys who come out before they come out.
Well, that's the other thing I wanted to ask you about. One of the other big differences besides the velocity is just the profile does not exist in Cuba. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, most of the guys that you have on this list who are position players, if they're not outfielders, they play second base. And that is different than any other market. There's not a giant rush on college second baseman in the draft. There's not a rush on high school second baseman. We had Forrest Wall, who's one of the highest drafted second basemen out of high school in the history of the draft this year. Forrest Wall can rake. That guy's really good. But, you know, in the Dominican and in Venezuela, and your coverage of Latin American prospects, are second basemen at a priority? And that, my sense is never, not really. And yet in Cuba, you put a list of 15 prospects together, and it's hitter dominated, but three or four of these guys are second basemen. Is that just a fluke, or is just the profile different when you watch Cuban baseball, where a guy who may profile at one position if he were in the U.S. or Canada would profile plays a different position in Cuba?
It's a good question. I hadn't really thought of it that way. And you know, obviously Gurriel is another guy who...
Right, second baseman for a lot of his career.
Yeah, and I'm sure he could play it right now too. I think he still has the athleticism and certainly plenty of arm and the range to play there too. Now, if I don't expect him to ever leave Cuba, but if he ever did, that flexibility would make him even more marketable. But
yeah, I think he's a member. If memory serves, either he's a member of the party, like every member of the family is in the party. I know his father. When his baseball career ended, he had a government job. Like he was like in the Ministry of Sport, and he was a member of the Communist Party in Cuba. So I don't know if that confers party membership on the rest of the family, but I think it would be very difficult for to imagine a member of the party leaving, because that certainly, when you're a star baseball player and you're in the party, that tends to bring privileges that other Cubans don't have.
Yeah, I mean, you can see how much, you know, they certainly trust him too, especially if you're letting a guy go to Japan the way they let him and Frederick Cepeda and Alfredo Despaigne. You know, they're letting these guys leave the country for a reason. They have confidence that they're not going to be going anywhere if they let them out. So I would say those guys certainly have a very low chance, unless I think Cuba clearly wants to make money off these players. I would not be surprised if more players end up playing in Japan, given that it sounds like the majority of the money in their salaries goes back to the Cuban government. So this is a way for the Cuban government to make money off these players. And I'm sure if they could sell them directly to major league teams, they would be elated to do that. But obviously there's laws that would prevent that from happening. But
they could function like an independent league, though.
Similar to like the Mexican league, I think, is the model
right, that
you want, where, all right, well, we'll sell you the rights, you know, we'll sell you this guy, but we're going to keep, you know, 75% or 80% of the contract in exchange for, you know, your ability to have this guy on your roster.
Now, one other thing with that I did want to ask you was, it does seem like that has changed a little bit, though, the rhetoric that comes out of Cuba when a player leaves.
Mm-hmm.
You follow this even closer than we do, so I wanted to ask you. I remember 5-10 years ago when a player left, it was pretty much that he was a non-entity who was a traitor to the cause. And I mean, it was...
Seriously. He ceased to exist.
And now there seems to be... Obviously, that's not for the Cuban people. That's been the Cuban government's viewpoint. But it seems to be that there's a little bit more...
A lot more
acceptance of pride, even on a governmental level, of look at what these players are doing in U.S. baseball.
And they celebrated. It felt like the Cuban... I remember reading at the Havana Times, they were celebrating the five Cubans who were in the All-Star game this year. That would never have happened when Contreras was playing. That would never have happened.
Yeah, it's the attitude has definitely changed, and I think it goes back to, like, we're seeing these loosening restrictions of Cuban players who are being allowed to play in Japan, or I think they thought Mexico was going to be more of an open opportunity for them, but obviously that seems to have been, for the most part, shut down, unless you're using an illegal passport, I guess, but... But yeah, there's I think it just boils back to the people who are, you know, running the show in Cuba right now are much more amenable to the idea of, oh, we can sell these guys, sell their rights or lease their rights to other leagues, and we can make money off them doing that. Yeah, that sounds great, especially given the financial struggles that the league there is having. I mean, it's they are not opposed to making money off these players, and I think if laws ever change in the United States, which might happen and would dramatically transform the marketplace for Cuban talent, I think they want to be ready for if that ever happens, so that they can, you know, make money off these guys.
One other thing kind of along those lines, you talked about the possibility of there being kind of a, you know, some changes in the rules, maybe, you know, down the road. Going back though to like these guys playing in Japan, the thing that jumps out to me is this is also important for Cuban players, because this is a better caliber of competition. That I think there is actually some usefulness. You talk about, you know, how for Goriel and all, it seems like the light bulb turned back on a little bit. How important do you think it is for these players who get this opportunity, not just in the occasional tournament, but to actually, as we see more and more of these players, especially going to Japan, how much does this help them from the standpoint of developing their skills, because they're facing better competition?
Or even just playing last year in the Caribbean Series, even though it was only one team, like you said. I mean, to JJ's point, I'm piggybacking on his question while interrupting it, but it feels like do you feel like the Cuban sports ministry or the government decided they needed this increased level of competition for their players, or do you think it's just money-making, or maybe a little bit of both? Because I think JJ's right. I think there's a big aspect to this is the increased competition level for these players that maybe being so insular was not helping their players get better.
I think I think it does help the players get better just by playing against more advanced competition. I mean, it would be like if you had a 28-year-old player like Despaigne, but let's say you never let him, you know, advance past the Florida State League. I mean, would he develop? He probably would continue to become a better player, but he not as good as he probably would be if you let him face Double A, Triple A, and obviously Major League pitching. So I think facing more advanced pitching and more advanced fielding too, in a lot of cases in Japan, certainly helps the players develop. But I think the primary motivations for that were for the Cuban government to make money off these players, and then to provide some incentive perhaps for players to try to stay in Cuba. So, all right, look, the money is getting so big now where Rusny Castillo is getting $72.5 million. You know, if somebody really, really wants to leave Cuba and, you know, wants to make a $50 million contract or even what did Iglesias get, 27 or, yeah, or $30 million or so from the Reds. You know, if they're that motivated to leave, they're going to leave. But at the same time, you know, if you do provide this outlet for them to play in Japan and test their skills against better competition and make some more money for themselves, you know, maybe that reduces the incentive for guys to want to leave and to try to defect from Cuba. And it's, you know, you make that kind of money and you bring it back to Cuba, you know, you can live pretty well, even if you're only bringing back 20% or whatever the percentage is of the contract that actually goes to the players themselves, and you're not having to go through these risks that somebody like Leonis Martin or Yasiel Puig or a lot of these other guys go through when they're defecting through you know, these channels of human traffickers and leaving their families behind and wondering if they're ever going to see him again. So I think between the incentives of trying to make money off these guys and trying to stem the wave of defections that have come over, I think those are really the two main motivations for the Cuban government to allow these guys to play overseas.
That certainly makes sense. And it really does feel like, Ben, like if the Cuban government had to do it over again, and I'm presupposing a lot here, but you always wonder, I there were such close ties between Cuba and Venezuela when Hugo Chavez was in charge of Venezuela, and was in the direction that baseball's gone in. MLB's relationship with Venezuela and signing Venezuela's players has gone backwards in the last decade, with the Venezuelan summer leagues down to what, 5 teams now. Most of these players, you know, with their showcase by their trainers, are brought to the Dominican now. They don't stay in Venezuela. Growing chaos, economy kind of in shambles. But 10, 15 years ago, this was a petro state with a lot of oil money. You almost wonder if that would have been an outlet for Cuban players where they could have played in some kind of Venezuelan league underwritten by oil money. But Hugo Chavez had bigger problems, obviously, than fixing a baseball league. But I mean, this is I'm not basing this off. I'm not making this up. This was Peter Barkman's idea, was that this was what was going to happen. He wrote this article about 10 years ago that there was going to be a Venezuelan league underwritten by oil money. Because I think that the Cubans saw it coming, but this is their only outlet. I think they wanted to play in Mexico. I think they would prefer to go to Mexico, Ben, but Mexican league being part of the National Association kind of was to put in the BA vernacular, a fly in the ointment there.
Yeah, that's basically what got that shut down. I was expecting, and I think the Cuban government was expecting, and the Mexican league was counting on, I don't know about hundreds, but certainly dozens and dozens of Cubans coming over to the Mexican league, not necessarily all star players like Alfredo Despaigne, but just, you know, solid AA, AAA caliber guys who could come over and be really good players in the Mexican league. And obviously that got shut down because of, the concerns over OFAC law.
Yeah, the Barbaro Canizares caliber player. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that caliber. That's a 4A type player, good, solid AAA player. That was a Cuban who played in the International League for several years, and now he's playing in Mexico, and that's a good Mexican League player. Or Ronnie Mostelier. I mean, like, Yankee fans remember Ronnie Mostelier from the last couple of years. That guy's raking in Mexico right now. So that's a perfect league. It's really a shame. I'm just looking at the Mexican League stats. There are two Cubans in the top 10 hitters who are in that regular. That regular season's already over. And the pitching leader is Amaury Sanit, other Cuban, former Mets prospect, led the Mexican League in ERA. So, I mean, that's a perfect league for Jose Contreras, was 10th in the Mexican League in ERA this year. Wow, I didn't even know he was still there. So that's a perfect league for Cubans. It's a shame that that couldn't work out, because I think we would have been funding some trips for Ben Badler to Mexico if that had happened. So you could have had some trips down there. Ben, we're going to wrap up the podcast unless you had any other thoughts on this Cuban market. But great work, obviously, on the prospect list from Cuba. Anything else you had to add?
No, I think, now it sounds like the next two guys, we were talking about separating the real prospects from the suspects in Cuba. And I mean, the two main guys to know now, there's probably 100, if not more, Cuban defectors who are running around the Dominican Republic and various countries who are probably organizational type guys at best, or very fringe prospects. But definitely the next name to know right now is Yasmani Tomas, big time power hitter. Saw him at the World Baseball Classic, and right. I think every scout who saw him there. There's some concerns about the swing, but he was extremely impressive there. Then when we saw him at the
last summer in Durham,
last summer when he came and played against the U.S. college national team, and everybody there was throwing, 94 plus, and he had a lot of trouble catching up to that velocity or hitting good breaking pitches. And then from seeing him in Cuba this year, probably saw him take just off the top of my head, maybe 30 plus at bats, maybe a little bit more than that. He didn't look quite as good as he did in Japan in the World Baseball Classic, but look, the power is there. There's arm strength to play in right field. This is a guy who maybe it's questionable whether he's ready right away. Might be a guy who would go to AAA at first, but I could see a team, whatever team's going to make a sizable investment in him, putting him straight to the big leagues. He'd be You know, I could see him going straight there. So he's going to be the probably the next big name to know. And then the
and he's the a more, big boy. He's,
yeah,
he's like 6'2", 230, right?
Yeah, he's a big lower half. That's
that's what I recall. Sure.
He's a very thickly built individual, but he actually moves surprisingly well. He's, you know, he's not a, I don't think he's even an average runner. He's more of like a 40, 45 at best type runner. Although we've seen these Cuban guys come over, get into better shape and start running faster, even in their mid-20s, like an Alexander Guerrero was doing. So he's obviously going to be something to track going forward. So he's a name to know. And then Yoan Moncada.
Yeah, that was a great article you had on Friday. That was fun. Moncada, whether he's a Generation Y player or not, he sounds like there's a high risk because there's less certainty with this guy, but it sounds like tools-wise, he's the most exciting young Cuban out there.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who, you know, they have these junior leagues in Cuba that are, you know, 16 and under and 18 and under, and, you know, when Puig was in those leagues, he just completely demolished those levels, and then he played in Serie Nacional and, you know, had that, you know, one big year before he got suspended. Puig, I mean, but, you know, Moncada had a, you know, similar track record in those leagues. Every time he went to an international tournament, the junior level scouts were jumping up and down about him. He really, really impressed them with his, you know, his size. I mean, he's not like a, you know, 180 pound, like, you know, wiry guy. He is a big, thick dude, but he can really run. He's got hitting ability. He's got power too. You know, you can put him in at second base. You can put him at third base, maybe even center field with his speed. You know, the bat, if you believe in it enough, I'm probably for some teams, I'm sure would profile even in a corner outfield spot too. So it's not really clear what's going on with him, but I mean, I would put him in the caliber of you know, of a guy like Puig or of a guy like Soler when these guys were the same age. This is definitely one of the best up and coming young players to come out of Cuba that scouts have known and followed for several years. He just hasn't had the opportunity in recent years to showcase his skills for the top national team, just because he is still 19 years old.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to me. And like you said, the key now is teams used to wait, and like their big way to see Cuban players was in the Olympics or World Cup or these big national tournaments. And if you wait on those to scout these guys, you lose.
And if you wait the Olympics, you really lose. If you wait the Olympics, it's like, wait, I'm not seeing these guys.
You're having to scout Eddie Alvarez in the Winter Olympics. Boy, that speed skating really is going to translate to baseball. So that's a whole other story and a whole other podcast. But great stuff, Ben. Really enjoyed it. Thanks for making the time today. And obviously, subscribers, check that out. And I also like the companion piece Ben wrote on kind of what it's like to watch a lot of Cuban games. So if only we could do that in person with some arroz con pollo or some plantains. I would love a trip to Cuba. That's a bucket list kind of trip to make, just to go see some Cuban baseball. But we'll see if that changes in the next. I have to hope that the last 50 years, that the past is not prologued what the next 50 years are going to be in American-Cuban relations. But we'll leave the politics out of the podcast. Great stuff, Ben. Thanks for the help, JJ. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you in the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.